The Third Eye by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa. Read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 6. Life in the Lamasery. 2 weeks went by, and my body burns were very much better. My leg was still troublesome, but at least it was making progress. I asked if I could resume normal routine, as I wanted to be moving about more. It was agreed that I should, but I was given permission to sit in any way I could, or to lie on my face. Tibetans sit cross-legged, in what we call the lotus attitude, but my leg disability definitely prevented that. On the first afternoon of my return, there was work in the kitchens. My job was to have a slate and keep check of the number of bags of barley being roasted. The barley was spread out on a stone floor, which was smoking hot. Beneath was the furnace at which I had been burned. The barley was evenly distributed and the door shut. While that lot was roasting, we trooped along a corridor to a room where we cracked barley, which had previously been roasted. There was a rough stone basin, cone-shaped and about 8 feet across at the widest part. The internal surface was grooved and scored to hold grains of barley. A large stone, also cone-shaped, fitted loosely into the basin. It was supported by an age-worn beam which passed through it, and to which were fixed smaller beams, like the spokes of a wheel without a rim. Roasted barley was poured into the basin, and the monks and boys strained at the spokes to turn the stone, which weighed many tons. Once it was started, it was not so bad. Then we all trooped around singing songs. I could sing here without reprimand. Starting the wretched stone was terrible. Everyone had to lend a hand to get it moving. Then, once moving, great care was taken to make sure it did not stop. Fresh supplies of roasted barley were poured in as the crushed grains dropped out of the bottom of the basin. All the cracked barley was taken away, spread out on hot stones, and roasted again. That was the basis of sampa. Each of us boys carried a week's supply of sampa on us, or, more correctly, we carried the cracked and roasted barley on us. At mealtimes, we poured a little of it from our leather bags into our bowls. Then we would add buttered tea, stirring with our fingers until the mass was like dough, and then we would eat it. The next day, we had to work helping to make tea. We went to another part of the kitchens where there was a cauldron holding 150 gallons. This had been scoured out with sand and now gleamed like new metal. Earlier in the day it had been half filled with water, and this was now boiling and steaming. We had to fetch bricks of tea and crush them up. Each brick was about 14 to 16 pounds in weight and had been brought to Lhasa over the mountain passes from China and India. The crushed pieces were tossed into the boiling water. A monk would add a great block of salt, and another would put in an amount of soda. When everything was boiling again, shovelfuls of clarified butter would be added, and the whole lot boiled for hours. This mixture had a very good food value, and with the sampa, was quite sufficient to sustain life. At all times, the tea was kept hot, and as one cauldron became used, another was filled and prepared. The worst part of preparing this tea was tending the fires. The yak dung, which we used instead of wood as fuel, is dried into the form of slabs, and there is an almost inexhaustible supply of it. When put on the fires, it sends out clouds of evil-smelling, acrid smoke. Everything in range of the smoke would gradually become blackened. Woodwork would eventually look like ebony, and faces exposed to it for long would become grimed by smoke-filled pores. We had to help with all this menial work, not because there was a shortage of labor, but so that there should not be too much class distinction. We believe that the only enemy is the man you do not know. Work alongside a man, talk to him, know him, and he ceases to be an enemy. In Tibet, on one day in every year, those in authority set aside their powers, and then any subordinate can say exactly what they think. If an abbot has been harsh during the year, he is told about it, and if the criticism is just, no action can be taken against the subordinate. It is a system that works well and is rarely abused. It provides a means of justice against the powerful and gives the lower ranks a feeling that they have some say after all. There was a lot to be studied in the classrooms. We sat in rows on the floor. When the teacher was lecturing to us or writing on his wall board, he stood in front of us. But when we were working at our lessons, he walked about at the back of us, and we had to work hard all the time, as we did not know which of us was being watched. He carried a very substantial stick and did not hesitate to use it on any part of us within immediate reach. Shoulders, arms, backs, or the more orthodox place, it did not matter at all to the teachers. One place was as good as another. We studied a lot of mathematics because that was a subject which was essential for astrological work. Our astrology was no mere hit or miss affair, but was worked out according to scientific principles. I had a lot of astrology drummed into me because it was necessary to use it in medical work. It is better to treat a person according to their astrological type than to prescribe something quite haphazardly in the hope that it once cured a person it may again. There were large wall charts dealing with astrology and others showing pictures of various herbs. These latter were changed every week, and we were expected to be entirely familiar with the appearance of all the plants. Later, we would be taken on excursions to gather and prepare these herbs, but we were not allowed to go on these until we had a far better knowledge and could be trusted to pick the right varieties. These herb-gathering expeditions, which were in the fall of the year, were a very popular relaxation from the strict routine of the lamastic life. Sometimes such a visit would last for 3 months and would take one to the highlands, an area of ice-bound land, 20 to 25,000 feet above the sea, where the vast ice sheets were interrupted by green valleys heated by hot springs. Here, one could have an experience matched perhaps nowhere else in the world. In moving 50 yards, one could range from a temperature of 40 below zero to 100 or more Fahrenheit above. This area was quite unexplored, except by a few of us monks. Our religious instruction was quite intensive. Every morning we had to recite the laws and steps of the Middle Way. These laws were: 1. Have faith in the leaders of the lamasery and country. 2. Perform religious observances and study hard. 3. Pay honor to the parents. 4. Respect the virtuous. 5. Honor elders and those of high birth. 6. Help one's country. 7. Be honest and truthful in all things. 8. Pay heed to friends and relatives. 9. Make the best use of food and wealth. 10. Follow the example of those who are good. 11. Show gratitude and return kindness. 12. Give fair measure in all things. 13. Be free from jealousy and envy. 14. Refrain from scandal. 15. Be gentle in speech and in action, and harm none. 16. Bear suffering and distress with patience and meekness. We were constantly told that if everyone obeyed these laws, there would be no strife or disharmony. Our lamasery was noted for its austerity and rigorous training. Quite a number of monks came from other lamaseries and then left in search of softer conditions. We looked upon them as failures, and upon ourselves as of the elite. Many other lamaseries had no night services. The monks went to bed at dark and stayed there until dawn. To us, they seemed soft and effete, and although we grumbled to ourselves, we would have grumbled still more if our schedule had been altered to bring us to the inefficient level of the others. The first year was particularly hard. Then was the time to weed out those who were failures. Only the strongest could survive on visits to the frozen highlands in search of herbs, and we of Shakpuri were the only men to go there. Wisely, our leaders decided to eliminate the unsuitable before they could in any way endanger others. During the first year, we had almost no relaxation, no amusements and games. Study and work occupied every waking moment. One of the things for which I am still grateful is the way in which we were taught to memorize. Most Tibetans have good memories, but we who were training to be medical monks had to know the names and the exact descriptions of a very large number of herbs, as well as knowing how they could be combined and used. We had to know much about astrology and be able to recite the whole of our sacred books. A method of memory training had been evolved through the centuries. We imagined that we were in a room lined with thousands and thousands of drawers. Each drawer was clearly labeled, and the writing on all the labels could be read with ease from where we stood. Every fact we were told had to be classified, and we were instructed to imagine that we opened the appropriate drawer and put the fact inside. We had to visualize it very clearly as we did it. Visualize the fact and the exact location of the drawer. With little practice, it was amazingly easy to, in imagination, enter the room, open the correct drawer, and extract the fact required, as well as all related facts. Our teachers went to great pains to ram home the need for good memories. They would shoot questions at us merely to test our memories. The questions would be quite unrelated to each other, so that we could not follow a trend and take an easy path. Often it would be questions on obscure pages of the sacred books, interspersed with queries about herbs. The punishment for forgetfulness was most severe. Forgetting was the unforgivable crime and was punished with a severe beating. We were not given a long time in which to try to remember. The teacher would say, "You boy, I want to know the fifth line of the 18th page of the 7th volume of the Kang Yur. Open the drawer now. What is it?" Unless one could answer within 10 seconds, it was as well not to answer, because the punishment would be even worse if there was any mistake, no matter how slight. It is a good system, though, and does train the memory. We could not carry books of facts. Our books were usually about 3 feet wide by about 18 inches long. Loose sheets of paper held unbound between wooden covers. Certainly I found a good memory to be of the utmost value in later years. During the first 12 months, we were not allowed out of the lamasery grounds. Those who did leave were not permitted to return. This was a rule peculiar to Chakpori. Because the discipline was so strict, it was feared that if we were allowed out, we should not return. I admit that I should have run for it, if I had had anywhere to run to. After the first year, we were used to it. The first year, we were not permitted to play any games at all. We were kept hard at work the whole time, and this most effectively weeded out those who were weak and unable to stand the strain. After these first hard months, we found that we had almost forgotten how to play. Our sports and exercises were designed to toughen us and be of some practical use in later life. I retained my earlier fondness for stilt walking, and now I was able to devote some time to it. We started with stilts, which lifted our feet our own height above ground. As we became more adept, we used longer stilts, usually about 10 feet high. On those, we strutted about the courtyards, peering into windows, and generally making a nuisance of ourselves. No balancing pole was used. When we desired to stay in one place, we rocked from foot to foot as if we were marking time. That enabled us to maintain our balance and position. There was no risk of falling off if one was reasonably alert. We fought battles on stilts. 2 teams of us, usually 10 a side, would line up about 30 yards apart, and then, on a given signal, we would charge each other, uttering wild whoops calculated to frighten off the sky demons. As I have said, I was in a class of boys much older and bigger than myself. This gave me an advantage when it came to stilt fights. The others lumbered along heavily, and I could nip in among them and pull a stilt here and push one there and so send the riders toppling. On horseback, I was not so good, but when I had to stand or fall on my own resources, I could make my way. Another use for stilts for us boys was when we crossed streams. We could wade carefully across and save a long detour to the nearest ford. I remember once I was ambling along on 6-foot stilts. A stream was in the way, and I wanted to cross. The water was deep right from the banks. There was no shallow part at all. I sat on the bank and lowered my stilted legs in. The water came to my knees. As I walked out in midstream, it rose nearly to my waist. Just then, I heard running footsteps. A man hurried along the path and gave the merest glance at the small boy crossing the water. Apparently, seeing that the stream did not reach my waist, he thought, "Ah, here is a shallow spot." There was a sudden splash, and the man disappeared completely. Then there was a flurry of water, and the man's head came above the surface. His clutching hands reached the bank, and he hauled himself to the land. His language was truly horrible, and the threats of what he was going to do to me almost curdled my blood. I hurried off to the far bank, and when I too reached the shore, I think that never before had I traveled so fast on stilts. One danger of stilts was the wind, which always seemed to be blowing in Tibet. We would be playing in a courtyard on stilts, and in the excitement of the game, we would forget the wind and stride out beyond the sheltering wall. A gust of wind would billow out our robes, and over we would go, a tangle of arms and legs and stilts. There were very few casualties. Our studies in judo taught us how to fall without harming ourselves. Often we would have bruises and scraped knees, but we ignored those trifles. Of course, there were some who could almost trip over their shadow. Some clumsy boys never learned break falls, and they at times sustained a broken arm or leg. There was one boy who would walk along on his stilts and then turn a somersault between the shafts. He seemed to hold on to the end of the stilts, take his feet from the steps, and twist himself round in a complete circle. Up his feet would go, straight over his head, and down to find the steps every time. He did it time after time, almost never missing a step or breaking the rhythm of his walk. I could jump on stilts, but the first time I did so, I landed heavily. The two steps sheared right off, and I made a hasty descent. After that, I made sure that the stilt steps were well fastened. Just before my 8th birthday, the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, told me that the astrologers had predicted that the day following my birthday would be a good time to open the third eye. This did not upset me at all. I knew that he would be there, and I had complete trust in him. As he had so often told me, with the third eye open, I should be able to see people as they were. To us, the body was a mere shell activated by the greater self, the over-self, that takes over when one is asleep or leaves this life. We believe that man is placed in the infirm physical body so that he can learn lessons and progress. He lays down to rest, and the spirit disengages itself from the physical body and floats off when sleep comes. The spirit is kept in contact with the physical body by a silver cord, which is there until the moment of death. The dreams which one has are experiences undergone in the spirit plane of sleep. When the spirit returns to the body, the shock of waking distorts the dream memory unless one has had special training, and so the dream may appear wildly improbable to one in the waking state. But this will be mentioned rather more fully later when I state my own experiences in this connection. The aura which surrounds the body, and which anyone can be taught to see under suitable conditions, is merely a reflection of the life force burning within. We believe that this force is electric, the same as lightning. Now, in the West, scientists can measure and record the electric brain waves. People who scoff at such things should remember this, and remember too the corona of the sun. Here, flames protrude millions of miles from the sun's disk. The average person cannot see this corona, but in times of total eclipse, it is visible to anyone who cares to look. It really does not matter whether people believe it or not. Disbelief will not extinguish the sun's corona. It is still there. So is the human aura. It was this aura, among other things, which I was going to be able to see when the third eye was opened. End of chapter 6.